and welcome to Season 5, Episode 1 of the Summer Library Podcast. I am Paul Sorrell, along with Stephen Mount. How are you, sir?
Doing well. How about you?
I am doing okay. And it's been a while since we have last spoken on a podcast.
You don't want to strain our vocal cords or anything.
No, because the vocal cord trainer would have to come in and maybe massage a vocal cord, and that would be weird.
Do you massage vocal cords?
I don't know.
So, I don't think so.
No? Maybe not. I don't know. Salt water.
We'll have to consult some expert, vocal cord expert.
That's right. And I'm sure there are plenty out there who would be glad to give us their opinion on keeping the vocal cords in shape. So since the last time we spoke, the weather has gone from winter to spring.
Yes.
And we had some nice snow days to enjoy.
And as the flowers are coming up from the ground, so the Union Library is coming up as well.
It is. It's coming up from the ground, and it's taking a whole lot of shape that back in December, it wasn't. Now we have a dome coming up.
Yeah.
But lots of sports have gone through the channel as we are coming up to the basketball championships in the next couple weeks. But our own Union University basketball teams did well, had a very good season. The men were 20-11 and made the NCAA Division II tournament before they lost to Berry College in the first round. And also, the women made the Sweet 16, and they lost to Nova Southeastern University, but they had an overall record of 28-4.
That's great. This is the first year in Division II, right?
That's correct. The first full year where they can participate, I believe, in postseason play. And so they had real good seasons. Both of them had really good seasons. So I want to congratulate the teams and the coaches and the managers and cheerleaders and all those who are involved with the basketball. And of course, baseball and softball's season has started for Union, and their game started back in early February. And I can remember leaving campus one day, and the temperature was like 32, and they were having a baseball game, and I thought, oh my goodness, I would hate to be playing baseball.
Was the Super Bowl played yet? Super Bowl played yet?
I don't know. It's like early February. So, yeah.
That's early.
It is early. But they have a lot of games I guess they got to get to. But yeah, I don't know. Sitting in 32-degree weather, that'd be hard to do.
I mean, playing in 32-degree weather would be tough as well.
Yeah, especially if you're out in the outfield just kind of waiting, waiting around. Hopefully somebody will hit something your way before your hands freeze up.
Yes.
So, baseball season professionally opens up pretty soon. And I know that you're excited about that.
I am. About a week and a half until the season begins.
So are the Cardinals going to be a contender?
They should be a contender. Everything I've seen say they should be one of the more competitive teams in the National League. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are talking about the Cubs up and coming this year.
Yeah.
See what
they have. A new manager.
Every year is new, a new beginning for everybody, so
that's right.
It'll be interesting to see.
So that gets going pretty soon, and I'm not going to make a prediction this year because my prediction last year was so bad.
Was last year the Texas Rangers?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. But weren't they nearly the worst team?
I think they were the second to the worst team.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to pick a team this year.
Well, let one bad year deter you. This could be the year that you pick the champion.
It could be. Like you picked the NFL champion. Didn't you pick the Patriots to win the Super Bowl?
I believe so.
I think you did.
That seems right.
Props to you, my friend.
Well, thank you. I wasn't really going out on a limb or anything.
Well,
the Patriots, they're there about every year, every other year or so.
Yeah. Well, I picked two teams that kind of toyed with playing well, and then I think, well, one of them actually got into the playoffs.
Carolina
got into the playoffs, but they had a horrible
Kansas
record.
City?
Yeah, in Kansas
yeah,
City.
Okay.
Of course, your Chicago Bears that you picked to be the
that
NFC.
That was a bad pick.
Yeah, they
that was my out on a limb pick.
Yes,
it didn't work out so well.
Yes, out on a limb with a saw, and that happened.
It's kind of like my March Madness picks.
Do you have a pick for March Madness?
Everybody's picking Gonzaga. Yeah. So, no, I'm sorry, everybody's picking Kentucky.
Right.
So I picked Gonzaga.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you never know.
So,
but it would be kind of cool if Kentucky were to win it all and have a perfect season. Yeah. It's only happened, what, one time before?
Yeah, but 1976? I think Kentucky, if they were to do that, they would have the most consecutive wins in one season.
Wow.
I believe.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
So maybe they'll do it.
Yeah.
They certainly have a good shot. And, of course, something else, as we alluded to a little earlier, since December, since the last time we talked, the library has really come on. And we had the opportunity, you and I, to go inside and get a look at the construction from a different vantage point than we have been able to see, because we have been taking pictures every week of the progression. And this week we got to go into the interior.
Yeah, with our hard hats and reflective vests.
That's right, and our safety goggles.
That's right. You were going to ask what my impressions were before I cut you off.
That's okay.
It's very interesting. I'm glad that they know what they're doing, because I would have no clue. I know they've been trained in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Maybe they're good with their hands, which I am not. But yeah, it was very impressive to see everything going up and everybody working in tandem with one another and working together. It was very interesting to see it from the inside.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the interior of the new library at this point?
Well, there were a couple first impressions. I thought, wow, it's really wet in here. You know, the floors were all wet, and I don't know, I wasn't expecting that.
Hopefully it won't be that way when it opens.
Hopefully not. And then another thing, it was almost apocalyptic in nature inside, because, of course, it just seemed like something had blown up. You know, I got images of the pictures that have come back from the Titanic down at the bottom of the North Sea. You know, it's just the North Atlantic, and it's just kind of haunting. And
so, yeah, just to describe what it is, concrete floors, beams where the walls will be, but no walls up.
Right. And whatever coating that they had on some of the steel beams, I don't know if that was insulation or what it was, but that reminded me of the rust that was on the Titanic and just kind of an eerie feeling. And we were pretty much in there by ourselves after quitting time. And so it's going to have some really nice views of the campuses.
It'll look nice with the windows. It'll let a lot of natural light in, I think. It'll be nice.
Yeah, it'll be a nice structure. And then this past week, they started working on the dome itself, and that's been interesting to watch.
Do you imagine about half of it is up at this point?
Probably so, yeah.
Looks nice. It's tall. Notice it from the bypass.
Easily, yeah. And then I think on top of the dome, there'll be a cross, so... it's going to be a very...
very distinctive
It will
landmark.
Definitely be a landmark, exactly. And in comparison to Miller Tower, Miller Tower is dwarfed by this dome, if you look at it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was on the website, Union website, yesterday at some point, I think, and there was a picture where the library hadn't even been started to be constructed yet. It was a picture from the past, and so the whole landscape of the campus will change because of
absolutely.
The one building coming up.
And we have a display outside of the library showing the progression of the building, and I took some interior shots, and I'm taking some pictures of the dome, and that'll be up first part of April as we count down to the new library, which we're probably about a little over 6 months probably at this point from inhabiting the new space. And we got a chance to talk to the project superintendent, Ken Finley. He was real informative.
He was a nice guy.
Nice guy. Let us walk around, and appreciate Gary Carter for setting that up. And so we'll be going back in on occasion, taking some more photographs and seeing how the progression of the interior is. And of course, if anyone wants to follow the progression of the building of the new library, they can on Twitter at New Union Library, hashtag open the doors. And if they
and
want
the
to,
website also is newunionlibrary.com.
Right.
Also, and it gives a still shot photo at the time the page loads of the progression of the outside of the library.
Yes, and then you can also watch a time elapse from the very beginning to see where
it
is.
I think there's a drone video where a drone flies up over the top of it. It's a neat video to watch.
Yeah, so... And if you want to contribute, the name of the campaign is Open the Doors. And as Stephen said, just go to newunionlibrary.com and they'll have all the information. And we would love for you to contribute if you would like to. But it's exciting times for the library and exciting times for the campus. So lots to look forward to in the next few months. Now, we are at a point in the semester. We're getting close to spring break, so we're probably a little past half, because when we get back from spring break, I think there's only 5 weeks left of class, then exams. Mm. So that's 25 school days, basically. And I'm sure a lot of students who are writing papers and getting that in gear would like to know about library resources, and we have plenty of those available for students who are writing papers. And one of the big resources we have is our research coach.
It's a great service, yeah. They can set up appointments with a research coach, one of three.
Right.
Mm-hmm. On from the Union Library website, uu.edu/library, and there's a link on the right entitled Research Coach, and they can set up a time with them. Research coaches will help them find resources in the library, articles, books. If they need a book through interlibrary loan, if they find a book that we don't have, we can request it through interlibrary loan as well.
Right. And the research coaches are Melissa Moore, Jenny Lowry, and Anna Poor, and they do good work. And so if anyone is needing a little guidance in how to get started, they can certainly make an appointment with a research coach. Also, we have research guides, something in every major that is a good place to start your research. That'll give you ideas of where to go to look for materials, and that's on the website there. Pretty obvious.
Yeah, that'll be the first. It's the first place whenever somebody comes up with a research question. A lot of times, I'll point them to the research guides. Is the best place to start. Just look, they'll click on the research guides on the right side under quick links, I think, and then they'll find their major, click on that, and it'll give them a list of subject specific databases that we have, and then the general databases that we have underneath that. So that's a really good resource.
Yep. And then once they have written the paper and or are writing the paper and you need some help with how to reference things correctly, we have RefWorks, which is a resource that will format things and get you pointed in the right direction.
Yeah, you can add a bunch of citations from your paper in it, export them to one document. You'll want to read that over yourself to make sure all the capitalization punctuation is correct, but right. It's a very helpful. It'll save them for future reference and that sort of thing once you create an account. So it's a very helpful resource as well.
So lots of things for the person doing research and research papers that we have in the library. Now, if you don't want to be on point all the time and having to
study. You need a break every now and then.
You need a break. And we have things that will help you have a nice break.
We like have, what, Paul?
Well, Stephen, we have a really good DVD collection. And we have Academy Award winner movies. And we've got some more new movies coming in. So if you need a break and want to watch a movie, just come in. Doesn't cost anything.
It's kind of a focus of, we've been trying to get the Academy Award winners, is that right? To add many of those titles to the collection.
And then, of course, we have recreational reads, which are very interesting, lots of topics. And so if you need just to take a break from studying or writing papers, we have some things that are good diversions for students and faculty and staff. Movies are right up front, as well as new books, and then rec reads are right across from the circulation desk. So we hope that people will take advantage of that.
Also on today's podcast, we are delighted to welcome Patty Hamilton. Patty is a professor of English here at Union and has recently had a book of her poems published. So we look forward to talking to her about that as we come back right after this short break.
Did you know that the Union Library offers a variety of tools to help you with your research? This is Melissa Moore, one of the research coaches at the Union Library. We have research guides for every major, which provide you with selected databases, websites, and other research helps. We have research coaches who provide customized research assistance and are scheduled at your convenience. And we have RefWorks, which helps you manage your citations and generate bibliographies. So, as you tackle your research projects this semester, don't forget to use the tools we provide for you. The right tools make all the difference.
Patty Hamilton is here with us today. Patty is a professor of English here at Union and a native of Southern California. Patty earned her PhD from the University of Georgia and is a published author. Her work has appeared in several journals, including Iodine Poetry Journal, Ibbotson Street, Cumberland River Review, Poetry South, and the Southern Poetry Anthology, Volume 6, Tennessee. She is the recipient of 2 Pushcart nominations and was a finalist for the 2013 Rash Poetry Award. She is also the author of a new book of poems titled The Distance to Nightfall. We are delighted to have Patty on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I have a question, first of all. You grew up in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
So where in Southern California did you grow up?
I grew up in Hemet, which is in Riverside County, and when I was born, it was a small agricultural community.
Mm-hmm.
My father was the manager of one of 2 banks, but it exploded in growth in the 60s, and I think when I graduated from high school, it was 6 times the size of when I was born, and it turned into a retirement community, and now it's kind of exurban.
Okay.
You know,
how
Los
far
Angeles.
From Los Angeles? Oh.
It was about, depending on where you're going in L.A., you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Okay.
About 90 miles, I think.
So about the distance from San Diego to Los Angeles.
Yeah,
somewhere in there.
Roughly.
North, south, east, west of Los Angeles?
Southeast.
Southeast, okay.
Uh-huh. And then I went to college at Biola University, which is 30 miles from downtown L.A.
Okay, yeah.
And I lived there for a number of years and taught at Cal State Fullerton. So I lived in that area until I moved to Georgia.
Okay. At one point, I was thinking about moving to Los Angeles, but went out there and visited and thought, no, I don't want to do that. No, thank you. So how do you get from Southern California to Georgia? What was the lure that got you there?
I got into the graduate program in English in Georgia. I already had a master's degree from Cal State Fullerton and had been teaching there for 7 years before I moved to Georgia to enter the doctoral program.
Okay.
And a poet friend, actually, had lived in Athens, Georgia, taught in the English department while his wife got her doctorate in banking and finance there, and they recommended it as a place that where I could have a nice quality of life while I was earning my doctorate.
Well,
you know,
good.
And it was a nice community, yeah. So I'm glad for that.
And Athens is a nice town.
Yeah.
Yes, and you're not too far from Atlanta.
Right.
If you get to miss the big city and things like that. Well, good. And how long have you been here at Union?
This is my 14th year here.
Okay.
So I've lived in Jackson now longer than I've lived any other place except my hometown.
Wow.
Where I lived till I was 18 and went off to college.
Okay. So you started here in 01?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, I started 3 weeks before 9/11.
Wow. Wow. That's a day.
Yeah,
that
so I can always remember when I started.
Yeah. Yeah. I started here in 2000. So we started very close to the same time. So when did you begin writing poetry?
Well, the first time probably in high school. I remember writing poems as a senior in high school. But then when I was taking my Brit Lit survey as an English major in college, which was about sophomore year, and started reading through British literature, I got very intimidated and stopped writing for a while. And then after my master's degree, I was involved in a writer's group, and that helped me, you know, get going again. And during that time, when I was teaching at Cal State Fullerton, I met the editor of South Coast Poetry Journal that was sponsored by the English department in part at Cal State Fullerton. And the editor invited me to take a class in poetry journal editing and then become part of his staff. So I did that for 2 years, and that really stimulated my interest in poetry. I got some real hands-on experience that way.
So what motivates you to write a poem? Do you see something? Do you feel something? Are you down? Are you happy? What gets you going?
It's a mystery to me. Sometimes I wish I knew what got me going, because it's like, gee, I wish I were writing something right now. I think my answer would reflect what most poets say, which is it can start with an image. It can start with a phrase. It can start with a feeling.
Right.
And I think mentally it depends on my level of attentiveness. I mean, there are just sometimes I'm too busy in the semester with slogging through the day-to-day, grading stacks of papers, to be attentive to what's going on around me in a way that allows me to process and select details. And then other times when things are a little calmer, I try to just tune in a little more and be receptive to ideas. But I think ultimately it's pretty mysterious about when an idea takes hold of you and you've just got to write about it.
Right. And when you're writing, how long does it usually take you to write a poem? Can you get some inspiration and then walk away and then come back? Or is it you put it down on paper that one time and then maybe come back and revise it?
All of the above. What I enjoy is when I get a spark and I can clear enough space to sit down and work an idea out sort of from beginning to end. But I don't always have that luxury, and some ideas are kind of recalcitrant, uncooperative. So then I just have to kind of leave a trail of breadcrumbs for myself to go back to. But even in the case where I can draft something that's, you know, pretty much got a shape that has a beginning, a middle, and an ending, revisions involved. And some of the poems in the book, I can show you 20 iterations of the poem. Maybe the shortest number of drafts I have done is 4.
Okay.
And so it just kind of depends on what problems present themselves after the first draft. And then sometimes you fix one problem in a draft and you create another. And, you know, you just have to be patient and let it sit a while so you can get some critical distance and then come back to it. You know, ultimately writers of any stripe need to teach themselves to read the writing as though someone else has written it. But that involves sometimes some time away from the work. So when you come back, it's fresh and you can see what's really on the page, not what you wish was on the page.
Yes, yes. Occasionally I will write a song lyric, and I have completed a few songs, but most are just scribbles of a couple of lines. I'll get inspired, and then it'll come to me, and as fast as it came to me, it's gone. And as much as I want to struggle and sit there and try to figure out, oh, what's in the good next line, I just can't do it. Now, this is usually for my own benefit, but that struggle is like, what is coming next? And then I'll go away from it, and a few weeks later, I'll have another thought for another line. Now, of course, good thing I'm not a professional songwriter, because I wouldn't have much work to do. But writing is tougher than what a lot of people may think it is. And so do you ever just get a block and you just cannot think, or you're not inspired? Does that ever happen to you?
Well, yeah, and I think most people who write professionally or semi-professionally just have to learn to ignore those blocks and find ways to write around them. You can't count on inspiration. Inspiration, you know, shows up about 5% of the time.
Right.
And the rest of it is sweat equity.
Right. I mean, you just have to write.
Yeah.
And some of it may be junk, and some of it may be just
I had a friend when I was in my first job after college. We worked in an office together, and he now is the head of the writing program at SUNY Oswego.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote a novel by getting up at 5 in the morning, you know, and writing before work every day. And he never published the novel, but what he learned and what he passed on to me is that nothing is wasted. And whatever you write gets you to the next thing.
Mm.
And so you have to do some self-talk sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And turn off the editor that says, this is junk.
Right.
And write it anyway because it may be what you need to get to the next thing that is going to be something.
Right, exactly. And when you are doing that, do you have a certain time of day that you like to write? Do you feel more?
Any time I can snatch is good.
Okay.
I mean, ideally, I could, you know, take time on a Sunday afternoon and, mm-hmm. you know, have a kind of quasi-Sabbath experience and feel serene and peaceful. I would say that's not typical, but, you know.
Right.
There are certain seasons I seem to write more in. I notice there's a lot of fall and spring imagery when mm-hmm. I put the book collection together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I would get to, maybe week 5 or 6 in the semester,
yeah.
fall or spring.
Right.
And I would have this pent-up need to be creative.
Yes, yes.
And so that would make me responsive and attentive and that what was going on seasonally wound
right.
up in my poems. So
right.
That's just a particular quirk of mine, I think. But
mm-hmm. Well, who were some of your influences?
I've been influenced by Ted Kooser, who was a former poet laureate. I read a book after I got to Union. I can't tell you what year. No, I had read some of his work before, but he had cancer. And while he was an insurance salesman in Nebraska, or not salesman, but executive, kind of like Wallace Stevens in the insurance biz, which doesn't seem very poetic.
Right.
But when he had cancer, he couldn't go out in the sunlight. And he and a writer friend of his made a pact during that time that they would write a poem every single day and send it to one another. And so the poetry collection that came out of that reflected the fact that he could only go outside before sunrise,
mm-hmm.
and he took a lot of walks in the dark. And that was helpful to me because it helped me really grasp how much you can get out of daily experience,
right.
kind of the humdrum mm-hmm. or the monotonous or the familiar, because the whole book reflects that period of his life, and he could craft poems out of anything.
Mm.
And that kind of gave me permission to just be attentive to my own life and, you know, not spectacular experience, but everyday experience,
right.
and work with that and look for the moments within that everyday experience that needed articulation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And is he still alive?
Huh?
Okay, okay.
Yeah, in fact, I've used one of his books on poetry writing when I've taught our advanced poetry writing class for the English major, because I think he's very practical.
Mm-hmm.
And
have you ever tried to get in contact with him?
No.
Why not? You should send him a copy of your book.
I have been published in the same journal.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
you should send him a copy of your book.
Counts.
You could do that. He would appreciate that, I'm sure. So can you tell the difference between a good poem and a bad poem? Or what is the way to tell a good poem from a bad poem? Like looking at a painting, and somebody can look at a painting, and it looks like somebody threw paint on a canvas. And yet, depending upon the artist, oh, it's great, fine art. And a 3-year-old could do the same thing, and it looked the same, But it's just a three-year-old throwing paint on a canvas. So how can you tell the difference? Is it a nuance? Is it a style? What is it?
I have kind of two opposite answers to that. I think, well, Kuzer talks about lift in poems, and especially in the conclusion of poems. He talks about that last line or the last couple lines or last image. You should have a sense of, I don't know if he uses the word buoyancy, but there's something at the end of the poem that lifts it up, and I don't even know how to define that, except that I would say it goes from the particular to something more general or universal.
Mm-hmm.
He says, poetry is a way to talk about one thing using another thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that resonates me, and it is a good advice to follow, to look for what's going to lift the poem at the mm-hmm. end. It's almost like it's airborne.
Right, right.
I think, too, that a lot of doggerel gets published, and we're conditioned by, the greeting card aisle in the supermarket
right.
to think if it rhymes, it must be a poem.
Right.
But I think there's some kind of complexity of ideation
mm-hmm.
That's involved. I personally think a good poem touches the head and the heart,
mm-hmm.
not one or the other.
Okay.
But my other answer is that there's really, if you read contemporary poetry, there's a huge array of styles and tastes.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody's going to define a successful poem differently. And I guess this is a blessing of the time we live in, that there's not one narrow definition. This is the style and you have to write in it, or
right.
you're not a poet.
Right.
It's a very democratized environment,
yes.
if you want to say it
yes.
like that. So there's no one answer to that.
Right.
And yet I think the poems that make it into anthologies that last over time, do something that appeals to the human spirit one way or another.
Mm.
And they're not just a flash and
sure.
they're gone. There's something lasting there that, makes people want to come back to them again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe get a little something different out of them at different stages of their lives.
Exactly, exactly. Now, you mentioned style. Do you have a particular style, or how would you classify your writing?
I had to think about that last week. I was in L.A. for a conference and got together with a longtime friend. She has a 16-year-old son, and at dinner he said, "What style is your poetry?" And I said, "Bidee, bidee, 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 bidee." I didn't know what to say in terms that would make sense to him.
Right.
I have some narrative poems. I have some shorter lyric poems. I don't know what label to put on them, except that I try to write poems that people could actually understand. It is not my goal to be obscure.
Yes.
It's not my goal to have, as students say, deep hidden meanings.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always about, writers aren't trying to hide their meanings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're not communicating if you're trying to hide your meaning. That's a contradiction in terms. However, what students need to learn about poetry is that writers use conventions of language. They may use cultural conventions. They
mm-hmm.
use, conventions of poetry. And you have to learn those. A convention is a set of guidelines or rules that you have to learn.
Right.
And so I think most poets, as they progress through their careers, are probably experimenting with employing different conventions as they go along. I wouldn't say that my poetry looks wildly experimental at all compared to, X other person.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm really trying to be accessible.
Sure.
People.
Yeah.
I want the person who is not quite sure he or she likes poetry
yeah.
to read or listen to mine and say, "Hey, that was kind of cool."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So how did the book come about?
A local writer, poet, and union alum, James Cherry, would come to events on campus where we had visiting writers, or I'd see him at community events, and we gradually became friends, and he started nudging me to put a book manuscript together. Generally, poets publish poems one at a time in mm-hmm. journals.
Mm-hmm.
A collection is defined as 48 to 84 pages, you know, so you have to have a substantial number of poems before it'll fit that manuscript length. And so he just gently would ask me every time, so you're working on a manuscript? Mm. So you're working on a manuscript? And I guess it finally kind of sunk in that, yeah, that is what I should be working towards.
Right.
But I had to have, you know, enough poems to fit in that manuscript length. And when I did, I had to find a pattern in which to arrange the poems so that they would cohere
mm-hmm.
as a manuscript. And then I submitted the manuscript. Typically, small presses publish poetry.
Uh-huh.
And they support themselves by running contests, annual contests, and you pay an entrance fee and submit your manuscript, and if you're the winner, you get published.
Cool.
And I picked a publisher that publishes a number of manuscripts from the contest. So I did not actually win that year's contest, but my manuscript was picked for publication,
mm-hmm.
for which I was very happy. And so I was lucky because I only sent my manuscript out to four contests, and
oh, wow.
you know, I got picked up right away. Mm-hmm. So that pleased me because, you know, it can take a number of years to go through that process
sure.
and some money out of pocket. But I think poets are willing to pay that money out of pocket to support the poetry industry. It's
right.
a kind of cottage industry. It's very small and
mm-hmm.
Underfunded. Mm-hmm. And so we all want to keep it afloat.
Sure. Now, how many years of poems is represented in your book?
Well, in terms of publication, about 10 years worth of individual poems getting published. But I mentioned seeing my friend last week in California, and it was great to hear her say, I read some of your poems, and I knew exactly where the setting was, which reminded me that some of those poems, the early poems in the book, have California settings, and I wrote them before I moved to Georgia. So
oh, wow.
really, that was, you know, more than 20 years ago.
Right.
But I was busy getting my doctorate, and I shoved them in a file in my file cabinet and mm-hmm. didn't think about them for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. When you go back and look at things that you wrote 10, 20 years ago, are you impressed by the growth that you have as not only a writer, but as a person and your experiences? How does that look to you?
I think I'd have to go back to my high school or college poetry to really, you know, have a sense of progression. And I haven't done that. I do have file folders in that very mm-hmm. file cabinet, and I could at some point. I just haven't gotten around to it. So
right.
I don't think there's any great growth spurt that's happened recently,
right.
Because I think there were 30 years of leading up to this book.
Okay, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
all that stuff that never saw the light of day, but
right.
that got me to the next thing.
Right, right.
All that's in the background. It's hidden in my file cabinet.
Okay. Now, will you please read us a poem or two from your book? That would be
sure.
wonderful. We would like to hear the author of the poems read, and the name of the book again is The Distance to Nightfall, and I will let you have the mic.
Thank you. This poem is called Homeless. With the warm weather, the white cat is back. As I draw water for coffee at the kitchen sink, I spy it sleeping on the broken black canvas chair, a jigsaw puzzle snug cat wrap. That tattered tail has seen better days. Where did the vagrant shelter all winter? Last year, it simply showed up, staking out sunny spots or shading under eave shadows, aloof. One searing midsummer day, I set out water in a red dish. But the rascal disdained my charity, left the drink untouched. Later, my neighbor complained the white cat cadged his kitty's food. Who can fathom the ancient instinct that weighs dignity against need? The squatter stretches on its makeshift bed, then begins its morning ablutions, licking a paw to swipe its ear, its white fur dingy, a smudge atop its head unreachable. Soon the old derelict will drowse again, sun-drenched, a slack sack of bones, its breathing so soft it might barely be alive.
Nice. Very nice.
That poem came out of everyday experience. I spoke of that earlier. We had a cat that just owned the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And just struck me one day there was a poem in that experience of my husband and I grew to feel affection for this cat, even mm-hmm. though he would never let us pet him.
Hmm.
It's a feral cat.
Mm-hmm.
And but we appreciated that cat.
Yes.
It's kind of the neighborhood pet.
Yes, very nice, very nice.
But it made me think about homelessness.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, so I think, again, poetry can be a way of talking about one thing using
right.
another thing.
Right, exactly, exactly. Very nice. And another one, please.
Okay, this one is called Saturday at Starbucks. And I had some scruples about whether or not I should name Starbucks in the poem. But mm. I voted in favor of naming Starbucks because I was trying to talk about a universal experience in the poem. And, well, Starbucks is universally recognized.
Okay.
On this April morning, warm enough to pry open the last buds clenched tight against a late frost, you can almost imagine we're slipping backward on the timeline. Ella Fitzgerald crooning "Begin the Begin" as people breeze in and out, nostalgic for the bounty of picnic hampers, the easy banter of tennis balls. Regulars, beguiled by the aroma of espresso, line up at the register, travel mugs ready, preparing for age-old rites of spring. Mowing expeditions through jungle lush weed growth in search of lost lawns. The jubilant exodus of patio furniture from dusky recesses in the garage. Each tree shimmering in the parking lot hums its new-leafed joy, harmonizing with the chatter of young mothers sipping chai, the murmur of couples sitting in the sunlight savoring the delights of frothy white foam, the soothing patter of the baristas, the contented susurration of steam. Though we're transitory as the whirl of pollen gilding the sidewalk, together we resonate like an ancient chord with the power to conjure that old specter, babble, and set it swaying, twisting, shaking, until at last it shivers into rubble, leaving us all speaking the same language.
Very nice. Well describes a morning at Starbucks. Yes, very nice. So how does it feel to have a book on a shelf?
It feels good, but it hasn't changed my life.
Well, do you ever feel vulnerable about the things that you've written, which are now available for public consumption and criticism?
I haven't thought about that too much. I guess I kind of select what I write about carefully. You know, I don't want to write about anything so personal that would ever embarrass anyone.
Right. Or just having a part of you out there.
Well, I have some poems about my parents passing, and I notice when I've read those in public before, I can get kind of emotional.
Right,
so
right.
Those are pretty personal. So I think, though, how we teach students to speak of poems is to talk about the narrator and the speaker. Mm-hmm. So some of these poems are biographical.
Mm-hmm.
But I think poets always do what's necessary to make the poem work.
Right.
And so we all have to learn how to depart from how it really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an aspect of in which these are all artifacts are fabricated. They're not just me writing in my diary.
Right, right.
They're artifice. They're fashioned. And so I think that gives me, and I would expect other poets, some critical distance from whatever the impetus was for the poem, if it was very personal.
Okay. Okay. So do you have any plans for any more books?
Yeah, I've written more than 30 poems past this volume, and have a number of poems out under submission right now, and you know, published about 18 of those 30 somethings.
Okay.
Recently, I had an idea of how I might thematize another book.
Oh, okay.
This first one is just kind of a collection, mm-hmm. and I arranged it, I hope, in an order that has a progression to it, but maybe the next book will have a thematic thread
mm-hmm.
holding the poems together in a way that goes beyond what this current volume does.
Okay.
I'm still playing with that idea.
Okay. And if people are interested in purchasing your book, where can they get it?
Locally from me, but my publisher has an online bookstore, so my publisher is Main Street Rag Publishing Company in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
And actually, you can Google the title, The Distance to Nightfall, and it will pop right up.
Wonderful, wonderful. And if you want to check out the book, we have a copy in our library, and the title again is The Distance to Nightfall, and I found out by trying to find it in our card catalog, or our online catalog, if you put Patty Hamilton in, it won't come up. It has to be Patricia. Hamilton. So, that's just a little shortcut for everybody. Patricia Hamilton, not Patty Hamilton. Well, Patty, it's been a delight to talk to you this afternoon. I appreciate you stopping by and joining us on the podcast, and I wish you all the best for your book.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure thing. And we will be back right after this. We'd like to thank Patty Hamilton once again for being our guest on today's podcast. And Patty will be at the Jackson-Madison County Public Library on Thursday, April 2nd at noon, where she will be reading more poems from her book, and will also have her book for sale. So if you are in town that day and would like to hear more of Patty's poems, just stop by the Jackson-Madison County Library at noon on Thursday, April 2nd. Also, an upcoming event where the library will be represented is the Employee Health and Benefits Fair, which will take place on Wednesday, April 8th in the Grant Center, and the library will have a booth. So if you are attending that event, please come by and say hello. We want to thank you for listening today, and before we leave, we would like to offer our sympathies and condolences to Beverly Absher and her family in the sudden and unexpected death on Tuesday, March 24th, of her husband, Keith Absher. Keith was a well-respected member of the union community and served as the dean of the McAfee School of Business Administration and professor of marketing here at Union. He was 63. And our thoughts and prayers go out to the Absher family.